Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to Heartland Politics here on KBUR AM-FM, Burlington, Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson. And today we're going to continue a look that we do periodically on this show at some of the towns, cities across the Midwest region that had their greatest days in manufacturing in prior years and have had some plant closures, major employer plant closures, similar to Burlington, right here where we're at in Des Moines County, where this show originates from. And so I was made aware of a book recently written by somebody I know up in Wisconsin concerning the closure of a General Motors facility in Janesville. And so I got this book. I read it really quick because it was pretty compelling, and the author was able to be with us today, and that's going to be our topic. What happens when these facilities shuts down, what leads to that, and then what's the impact of people, and what can cities do as they try to reinvent themselves after a major employer like this closes. The book is called Disassembled, A Native Son on Janesville and General Motors, A Story of Grit, Race, Gender, and Wishful Thinking, and What It Means for America. The author is Tim Cullen. This is his second book. He's a former state senator representing the Janesville area. And I'm very, very pleased to have you on today, Tim. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
So I've given a little bit of your political background, but you might talk more about your experience growing up with this major employer in town, and then why you decided to write this book and share this story.
Well, Janesville is a city of 60,000, and the largest employer since the 1920s has been General Motors until they closed in 2008. And to give you an idea of what kind of a clobbering that was to individuals and people as well as the community, was we're a city of 60,000. And between the employees who lost their jobs in 2008 at the plant, and then there were supplier plants that built up around Janesville, as do around a lot of the GM plants, other auto plants, they all lost their jobs. In total, in one 12-month period, 4,500 people with good-paying jobs, almost all of them UAW jobs, lost their jobs in a community of 60,000. At the exact same time, we had the national recession, the worst recession since the Great Depression. So, and at a time which we didn't know was that General Motors was going broke. We're trying to get them to keep one plant open. So that was sort of the environment in 2008. I grew up in a General Motors family. My grandpa worked there. My dad worked there. And because my dad worked there, my dad never finished 10th grade, they had a program where sons of workers who were going to college, they would hire for summer jobs. So I had a chance to work there for 4 summers. So I was actually in the plant working on different jobs, and so I have a very personal recollection of what it's like to do that. And sort of why I wrote the book now, the plant closed in 08. It sat there idle. GM had sort of kept it halfway alive, put it on this separate little list of plants. And then they finally sold it in 2016 or so and was bought by a developer, and now it's been torn down. That's the cover, picture in the cover of the book. That's partly what led to the title, Disassemble. But I thought, 11 years after the plant closed, it was time to write the story about what happened in 2008, why we closed, issues in the plant on race and gender back in the 60s, and why we were not able to keep it open, and then what's happened to Janesville and an awful lot of people who were affected by it in the last 10 or 11 years, and where is Janesville at now? 11 years later. That's kind of a long answer to your question. That's kind of the background.
No, that's fine. What led to the closure of this plant, Tim? I mean, there are some like the Galesburg Maytag facility, which I had my students working on, that closed due to globalization. The company shut down and opened up a factory south of the border. Did that play a role here? Was it technology? Was it just market trends?
Well, it wasn't taking jobs overseas. What happened in 2007 and 8, GM started to have trouble. In 2007, the year before we closed, GM closed 12 other plants around the country. they had way too much overcapacity is what was part of one of their several problems. And we were manufacturing highly profitable Suburbans, SUVs and larger trucks and so on. And they were making a lot of money on our vehicles, but they was always going to be okay as long as gas prices stayed somewhat under control. When they were in the $2 range, it was fine. Well, gas went up to $3 a gallon and spiked at $4 a gallon in 2008, and people stopped buying our vehicles. And so it doesn't matter how profitable they are if nobody's buying them. And so they stopped selling. They actually closed the night shift 6 months before they closed the whole thing. So that was a big problem, was the gas prices went up. And secondly, GM had all this overcapacity that they were trying to deal with. And we had the oldest physical plant in the whole GM system. It was originally built in 1918. And they had a plant in Arlington, Texas, which was building the same vehicles we were, which was a lot newer. It was built in the 1950s and had a newer paint shop and a lot of different details they had. And they no longer needed two facilities to make these large vehicles, these not so fuel efficient but very beautiful vehicles. So we ended up being the one that they closed.
It's ironic too, because you go through in the book and talk about how the union tried to work out in previous years. It was almost like a feeling they thought this was coming, and they sat down and tried to work out some changes in the contract to kind of help make the plant more competitive, but it really didn't in the end work out.
Well, it worked out for a while. What happened, I write a couple of different chapters on this. In 1984, General Motors announced, Detroit General Motors announced, they were going to move half of our production and half of our employment out of the Janesville plant into the new plant they were building down in Indiana. And so they announced that in 84. They usually make these announcements and then actually make move a couple of years later because the plant in Indiana wasn't finished yet. So in Fort Wayne. So during that time frame from 84 until they actually moved the product in 86, they never said a word about giving Janesville a new product to replace that. So they were silent for over 2 years. And so 86 comes, and the 1,800 jobs are going to be lost, and a little over half the plant was going to be dark. It was just got cut in half, basically, a little more than half. And we had a very, very forward-looking, fortunately, shop chairman of the UAW in Janesville named Jim Lee. Write all about him in the book too. He saw some other plants closing. He'd seen plants closing in about three other places in 86, and he knew that Janesville had to do something to get Detroit's attention, to give us a new product, not leave us half empty, because half empty plants can all of a sudden be totally empty. So he worked with the plant manager, who at the time, Mike Cubbin, who was also kind of a progressive guy and not an anti-union kind of plant manager. And they worked out a bunch of changes, a lot of which helped General Motors be more efficient and less costly to operate in Janesville, some of which helped the workers. But it took him guts to do it, because any concession he made that helped GM, he was going to get blowback from some of his members that he was selling out to the management. And every change he agreed to, the union had to vote on. So he had to not only make the best agreement he thought was in the best interest of keeping work in Janesville, he had to sell it to the union membership. And he did. Succeeded at it, and it resulted in really a great opportunity, because in 87 then, GM Detroit gave us the medium-duty truck production. And then just 2 years after that, in 89, they gave us the SUVs. And what that meant was that if the plant was clearly at some risk of getting closed then, those actions by Jim Lee and the UAW and a good plant manager kept the plant open for really another 22 years, rather than possibly having it closed in the 80s. We lasted until 2008.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Barack Obama plays a role in this book. He did in the Maytag story as well, where he campaigned. It was about, well, close to the same time. But he came in and gave a speech, which you reprinted in the book. You might tell that story a little. And was Obama able to make a difference for Janesville and this facility when it was going through these challenges?
Well, he comes to the plant in February of 08, so this is 10 months before the plant actually closes. So it's open, its production is not going well, sales are not going well. And he's running the Democratic presidential primary against Hillary Clinton in 2008. So he comes right to the plant and gives a major economic speech about what he would do if he's president. And I was there for it. And there were hundreds and hundreds of employees and management who were there to hear the speech. And what everybody wanted to hear him say, of course, was, if I become president, they're not going to close this plant. And I heard a speech, and I reprinted the whole thing so everybody can read it in the appendix. And he never said those kind of words. What he said, his key words were that if his economic policies are put in place in America when he becomes president, this plant will be here for another 100 years. Those were the key lines that people heard, and they loved it. That's not the same language as, if I'm president, I will not allow this plant to be closed. Mm-hmm. Didn't say that. And so I write, and then he becomes president, and then General Motors has to go through bankruptcy. He was really dragged through bankruptcy I write a lot about that, by the Obama administration. And, I started out with the book. A lot of people in Janesville think, gosh darn it, he came here, he wanted our votes for president, and we voted for him, blah, blah, blah. But then he was president, he could have whispered in GM's ear and saved us. And a lot of people felt that way. And the more I thought about it, I finally concluded that that's not what a President Obama would be able to do, because he was trying to make GM efficient when they came out of bankruptcy, so that the taxpayers could get paid back the billions of dollars that were used to bail out GM and keep them afloat as they went through bankruptcy and beyond. And the clincher for me, that why he couldn't probably do that, why I didn't really end up blaming him, was that 28 GM plants closed between 2007, 12 more in 2008, including us, and 12 more in 2009. That's 28 plants with UAW workers that he wanted support from in his run for president. How in the world, I concluded, could he whisper in GM's ear, you know, you're getting this money, but I want that Janesville plant to reopen it. It closed by this point by a few months. You know, what would he say to the all the workers who lost their jobs, the other 27 plants that supported them as well? You know, I took care of Janesville, but sorry about you guys. So I concluded that he really didn't have the right as president to do it, even though as a citizen of Janesville and everything else, I would have privately loved that he would have, but that's sort of the conclusion I came. But he ended up playing a role kind of at two different times.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on KBUR AM-FM, Burlington, Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and we're talking politics today with Tim Cullen, a former state senator from Janesville, Wisconsin, who's also an author. His most recent book, which just came out, is called Disassembled, A Native Son on Janesville and General Motors, A Story of Grit, Race, Gender, and Wishful Thinking and What It Means for America. This is part of a continuing series on this show of featuring books, policy experts, others on the challenges facing the factory towns in the heyday of manufacturing in this country in the 60s and 70s, 50s. Like Burlington, like Galesburg, Illinois, like Janesville. And so Tim's taken us through some of the factors that led to the closure. Now let's take a look at what's happened since then. What's been the impact on the community? Has it held up well since then? I mean, there's been some time that's gone by. How do you measure, first of all, how Janesville's doing, and has it landed on its feet after this huge economic shock?
Well, it's on its feet, but it hasn't, it isn't back to where it was when GM was open. I think the key thing is that when you lose that many jobs, over 6,000 jobs, the comeback is bound to be slow. Absent, you get some giant break, like GM comes back and opens again, or some other large manufacturer comes with wants to relocate into this vacant building and with 3,000 or 4,000 jobs. Absent some giant break like that happening, the comeback is going to be slow, and neither one of those big things happen. So we're gradually coming back. We have a lot of other things going for us, but what's happened is that may not be so different in a lot of the communities you talk about, is that is the middle class, the upper middle class in Janesville are doing fine. But one of the statistics that I like to use that measures poverty in a community is to look at the number of kids in the school district who are eligible for the, what they call the free or reduced lunch program. And those kids are eligible based on their family income and the size of their families. So larger families can have larger incomes and so on. Give you an idea of the picture by using that data. The year before General Motors closes in 07, 33% of the kids in Janesville are eligible for free and reduced lunch, 33% before the plant closes. The year after the plant closes, it jumps to 51%, 2009. And now, 11 years later, that 51% of the year after it closed is now 52%. There's a significant level of poverty in Janesville that's not all related to the plant closing, but to a significant degree related to it. So, but the city and the Chamber of Commerce people are working hard. They're trying to make Janesville, they're trying to do what they can to create what you might call a post-manufacturing economic environment in Janesville. And they haven't attracted a lot of those kinds of companies yet, but they're trying to make Janesville, using the riverfront as a key place to make the downtown beautiful, modern, and, you know, the kind of place that young workers from these yet-to-come businesses would want to live here and you know, go to the restaurants and so on and walk along the Riverwalk, et cetera. But it's been slow, I think those who cheerlead, I point out this out in the book, those who cheerlead too fast on the front end of these kinds of tragedies, these kinds of losses, are really sort of you know, not in touch with reality. They may have to do some cheerleading. You don't want to say your community is no good. But you you have to realize that these comebacks from these kinds of just huge blasts of unemployment. What happened was that unemployment went up with the recession. It's now way down. Unemployment in Janesville is not too bad. But I don't think unemployment, I say in the book, the unemployment rate is not really the most important measurement in a lot of ways. It's what the annual, what the household income is. What's the annual income of a worker? What's the hourly wage? Those are the things that are really matter. And those are lower in Janesville. They were going to be there. I mean, think about it. In 2008, the average line worker in Janesville was making $28 an hour. There are no manufacturing jobs in Janesville that are even, maybe some are $20 an hour at the most, 11 years later. But there's lots of jobs in the sort of $12 to $18 an hour range, but that's a whole lot different than having thousands at $28 an hour or more.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I've seen a gathering among other guests, and I was at an event in Chicago with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, which wrote a recent piece. My guest last week talked about it on the Midwest economy and how it was an interesting discussion on how some of the economic numbers don't give a full picture of reality on the ground. And I think I'm glad you brought that up, that the unemployment rate, you can't look at that in itself. There's so much more to look at, and I think the free and reduced lunch is one of them. Incomes, as you mentioned, and I think the percentage of people with college degrees seems to be strongly linked to incomes, and so those are other measures that to give a fuller picture of how a community's doing.
Right, and Janesville, you know, we're changing our culture quickly, but think about it. Back to the 1920s, if you were a young person in Janesville, especially if you had usually a father, there were more men there. That's a whole other story about gender bias there. But if your family worked, you had a parent that worked at the plant, that was a big help in terms of getting you hired. And so all you needed to do really was turn 18. You didn't even really actually have to have a high school diploma. Most of them did. And you can get a really good paying job that supported you and your family in a very good way. And that was the culture for, you know, for all through the, you know, the Depression hurt us like everywhere else, but especially if you go into the post-World War II era, in the late 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, all the way through there, there was a culture that it wasn't, you did not need a college degree to get a good paying job in Janesville, Wisconsin. You could get a job at General Motors, and there was a Parker Penn plant here that paid well, as well, another union plant. So that culture now is over, and that change is gradually taking place every year as kids start school and go through school. They realize there's not going to be that good-paying job at the end of high school in town at a significantly good middle-class wage. So that's happening. That people get it, and it's changing. But that's really a very different culture than the one that certainly the one that I grew up with.
It's a familiar story, and I'll take this question right from the subtitle in the book. What does this mean for America? What are the broader lessons that we can all learn from this story that you tell in this book?
Well, I write a whole chapter on that, and as you know, you read the book, and I point out a lot of things. 20 different specific things I point out in that chapter that other communities in America can learn that have gone through this or may be facing it. When a large corporation is in your community and they're the dominant employer, particularly if their corporate headquarters is not also in your state, which is very often the case, of course, these large corporations, your community is not in charge of whether or not those jobs stay in your community. This corporation is going to make the decision, and so there's actually a difference. The local management people, they're all for keeping the plant open because they lose their jobs too if the plant closes. But the corporation, it's going to look at their bottom line. In this case, we've got a General Motors plant in Janesville. Corporate headquarters is in Michigan. One of the things that we learned here, of course, was that we were the only General Motors assembly plant in Wisconsin. And so one of the things that I point out is that if you're in that situation, you should be on the ball all the time. Do not assume that they're going to stay, because if they have to shut a plant down, the easiest decision to be made from an out-of-state corporation is to shut the plant down where they have no other assembly plants, because then you shut the plant down, you irritate all the local officials and politicians and so on, and you leave, but you don't really have to particularly worry about it because you no longer are in that state. You no longer have any assembly plants in that state for where you've got to deal with those governors and legislators that you've offended. So there's lots of things like that you got to watch for. You kind of think, I summarize it in Janesville by saying, with sort of some slang, but I said that the problem was that Janesville thought for a long time the GM had married us, and the reality was they were always just dating us. Or I tried to summarize it in a nutshell. But having said all that, you do everything you can to make them want to stay in your place. They wanted a new interchange. Interstate 90 goes by Janesville. And they wanted a new interchange that would be more conducive to getting trucks from the interstate right down to the plant, bringing in supplies. We the taxpayers, built a whole new interchange for them, just built for them. I was majority leader at the time, and we just got that done. They wanted it. We got it for them. Then about 15 years later, the interchange wasn't enough because the trucks still had to go on some city streets and wind their way down to the plant. They wanted just a road built just from out by the interstate interchange directly to the plant, you know, with no side streets, just a road just for them. And I was gone from the legislature then, but the legislators and the governor at the time did what they wanted, provided the tax money and built the road, named the Reuther Way, by the way, after Walter Reuther.
That's right.
And so you do what you can. But you're not in charge, and that's I think a big lesson that a lot of communities can learn, especially if they still have one dominant or a couple dominant employers, to be aware of the power relationship, and the power is with the out-of-state corporation.
I thought that chapter was very useful, and folks, if you're interested in this, the other, Tim shared one of the big lessons there, but there are 19 others. You'll have to go get the book. And for my final question, Tim, I just wanted to ask where, if somebody out there is interested, I'm sure there might be some folks around here interested, where can they get a copy of the book? And please share where the proceeds of this book are going. I think that's an important part of the story here as well.
Okay, well, they can go to any bookstore. And the bookstore may in your area may well not have the book, but any bookstore can get it. They'll know how to get it. Usually 2 or 3 days they can get a book for you. So you can go to any bookstore, and they'll tell them you want to get disassembled, and they can get it for you. You can also buy it online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can buy it there as well. So you can get to a book pretty easily, even though the bookstore might not have it in stock right now. They might well not have it in stock in your area. And I hope people will buy it. And why I'm comfortable saying that is the second part of your question is that I don't make any money on this book. All of the profits from the book, and I don't take any expenses or any other gimmicks where you can get money. All the profits from this book go to a scholarship foundation that I started in Janesville several years ago. Janesville was once an all-white community when I was growing up. It's now much more racially diverse, and upwards of close to 30%, about 28% of the students in our Janesville school system are students of color, about 28%. Yet the teachers are almost all white. And so I started a scholarship foundation, provide scholarships for Janesville kids of color who want to be teachers, who then we give them our foundation. They get $5,000 a year for up to 5 years to go become a teacher, and then they agree to come back and apply for a teaching job in Janesville and teach in Janesville. So that's the whole thing, and that's where all the profits from this book and my first book go. And we've got some terrific teachers who have all gone through and are teaching in Janesville, and it's helping to make the people in the front of the classroom look a little bit more similar to a lot of the students. It's given me a chance to meet some terrific young people who are now terrific teachers. We have 8 teaching in Janesville through the program, and we have 9 in college, and we're going to be able to give out 4 more scholarships next month for next fall. So we'll have 13 in college. So we're cranking along, but as I think about it, one teacher for maybe up to 30 years, the difference in the number of lives they can make, just one teacher. So I did it because I wanted the students of color to see somebody in front of the classroom that they could become a teacher too, that someone that looked like them. But I also did it for the white students in Janesville, because for them to go through school all the way through and see all they see is white teachers and white administrators and so on, is not preparing them, those people in all the power positions being white, that's not preparing them for the world they're going to live in the United States in the next, now and even more so as this century goes on. So I really did it for all the kids. But that's where all the money goes. And so if you buy the book, all the profits, that's where it goes.
Paid right back into the community for a really good cause. That's great. Our guest today on Heartland Politics has been Tim Cullen. He's the former state senator in Wisconsin from the Janesville area. His previous book, by the way, dealt with a very interesting period in Wisconsin history when he was a group of senators who crossed state lines to come into Illinois during a really interesting period in Wisconsin's recent political history. But this book we've been talking about today is called Disassembled, A Native Son on Janesville and General Motors, A Story of Grit, Race, Gender, and Wishful Thinking, and What It Means for America. I highly recommend it for folks to take a look at. Again, there's some very similar experiences, I think, between these two communities here in Burlington and also up in Janesville and, of course, over in the Galesburg area as well. So the more we can talk about this, the more we can probably help leaders kind of perhaps get some ideas on moving communities forward when this type of thing happens. But, Tim, thank you so much for being a guest today, and Good luck, and I hope you continue to write.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Robin, and thank you to your listeners as well. And I think the end of the deal is that it's not easy to recover, but you can do it. But you got to go in with your eyes wide open.
You got to get up off the mat when you get knocked down.
Yep.
Okay, thanks again.
Thank you, Robin.